Session number 23346, Mr. Arthur Glanfield, reels 1 and 2 of ultimately 8. Left channel informant mic only, right channel interviewer's mic only.
Mr. Arthur Glanfield, reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Glanfield?
I was born on 17th of December, 1914, at Stockton-on-Tees, County Durham.
Could you tell us a little about your family and your early years?
My father was Arthur John Glanfield, who originally came from Devonshire, from Exeter, and his family were all in that area. And my mother came from parents who, the father was Scotch from Aberdeen and the mother was Welsh from the Cardiff area, I believe. And that's about all I...
What did they do for a living? What did your father do for a living?
My father was a gas engineer. And he worked for various firms, large firms, to do with the gas industry, and eventually joining his father's firm, which was at Exeter in Devonshire, and my grandfather was director of that company, which is now part of... I've forgotten the name of the company now, but anyway, it became a part of the United Gas Industry, which was taken over by Hansen Group, the present control of the company.
So what was your childhood like? Was that a comfortable upbringing from the sound of it? Was it a comfortable upbringing from the sound of it?
Yes. Definitely, it was comfortable.
And what about your education?
I was educated locally at the grammar school, and at the age of 12, I went to boarding school at Pocklington Grammar School in East Yorkshire, and I was there from the age of 12 until I left in December 1932, I think it was. Yes, December 1932, when I was approaching 18 years old.
And what was this, a day school or a boarding school?
This was a boarding and a day school. Very few people attended the day classes. It was mostly boarders because the town itself, Pocklington, didn't have a large population and there weren't many day boys.
And what do you remember, what was it like as a school? Can you give us an idea of what the school was like?
The school was a very good discipline, divided into different houses where At your early education, about 30 boys went to each of the four houses. The one I was in was called Wilberforce House, after one of the pupils who was there 100 years before, or nearly 100 years before. That was William Wilberforce. And about 2 or 3 years after I went there, I went up to the big school and remained there, of course, till the end.
What was the sort of teaching methods that they employed at the school? I mean, was it sort of very traditional?
I think it was traditional. A good many of the boarders came from clergymen. That's Church of England clergymen. There were very few Catholics, and the masters were, in my opinion, apart from the odd master, they were excellent teachers, and the classes were relatively small. You got very good teaching there.
And what about sport? Was that an important part of the equation at the school? Or
yes, sport was every afternoon except Sunday, and possibly Saturday afternoon if you weren't engaged in a game, which representing the school or something. And every afternoon from about 3:30 until 5, you did sport, rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer.
Were you keen?
Keener on the rugby than the cricket. I was never terribly keen on the cricket, but the rugby I took part in, and I did represent the school in one or two matches.
Was it a traditional public school or independent school in the sense of having a fagging system and prefects and that kind of thing, that sort of discipline system?
We had prefects there, but we didn't have fags. Everybody looked after themselves, and it was self-supporting by the boys, you might say.
Much bullying?
No. No bullying. It was so strict that bullying never occurred. The masters and the people who controlled the school in one way or another, including the physical training instructor, they really did their stuff, and they instilled on the boys the way to behave, and bullying was never an occurrence that I witnessed.
Now, what about the officers' training corps? Can you tell us about your training with them? Because I understand you're a member of it.
Yes. Everybody who was a boarder was obliged to become a member of the cadet force from the age of 12 anyway. And it took place on Tuesday in the afternoon. You had to wear and look after the uniform yourself of First World War style, including puttees, and in the summer it was a bit warm with this particular uniform, but it suited me. I didn't mind that at all. Most Tuesday afternoons, particularly in the winter, we went for a route march, and there was a certain amount of training on the barrack square, you might call it. The man in charge was Captain Whitehouse, who was an ex-First World War volunteer, I expect. And we had good discipline. The only thing which was a hardship for the younger boys was that on the route marches, we had to carry a Lee Enfield rifle of the First World War, and that bore down on your shoulders a bit after doing an hour or an hour and a half quick route march.
What about drill? How did you take to drill?
Oh, the drill was quite straightforward. There was no problem there. There weren't any pupils that I met that weren't able to cope with everything. So that was it.
What about weapons training? How far did you go with weapons training? Did you fire the Lee Enfields, or did you have the .22 versions?
With weapons training, we went to a 2-2 range from about the age of 15. And we I don't remember firing the Lee Enfield at all. I, for myself, was a very good shot. I don't think I reached the highest standard marksman or anything like that. But we had competitions with other schools on the with the 2-2, and I enjoyed that very much.
Well, what do you think made you a good shot? I mean,
I had very good eyesight, and I don't wear glasses, or I hadn't worn glasses until fairly recently. So,
you think that was the key point, rather than steadiness, or?
One of the points was all my life I've had a calm character. I've never been excited or rushed about or anything. I've always thought things out and remained calm.
What about bayonet training or any other weapons? Or?
We didn't do the hostile side of it. And we didn't use bayonets or anything like that.
So it's just really .22 training.
.22.
What about tactical exercises? You know, little tactical exercises.
Little.
Tactical exercising.
You know. We did a little of that in fields, but nothing serious. It was just pointed out how we did it, and you just went over to one end of the field and told what to do.
What sort of thing would you do?
Well, you just march behind cover positions and things like that.
What about summer camp? Did you go to camp?
There was no summer camp at all.
What about the Cert A? Did you actually take the Cert A?
No, there wasn't Cert A there.
And was there any promotion? Did you get any promotion?
No, there was just one or two of the outstanding cadets were made a sergeant or a corporal, and that was mainly for lining up purposes when you attended the parade.
Now, you were at Pocklington from 26 to 32.
That is correct, yes.
What were your plans? What qualifications had you got, and what were your plans on leaving the school?
I was very keen at school on chemistry, and my last term, I remember, I did 13 chemistry lessons a week. I was given the laboratory freedom every morning. The master was appealed to me particularly. He was a Dutchman called Mierendonk, and we were doing quite advanced chemistry. We were talking about bombing the atom and things like that, and I was very interested. But at that time, 1931, 1932, the scientists in chemistry, the BSCs, were walking the streets where I lived, because the nearby big firm, Imperial Chemical Industries, was at Billingham-on-Tees, very near where I lived. And I was, my father said, the chemical industry is no good for you at the moment, and it's no good following me in the gas industry, because he said that after 20 or 30 years people probably will not want gas. So when the time came, I was approaching 18, my father thought that I should go for something secure, and he arranged with the local bank at Stockton-on-Tees, where he did his business, to get me an entry in there.
And so as a clerk?
As a clerk, yes, to start my career in banking.
And can you tell us a bit about your work? I mean, because people don't know now what a bank clerk would do in the 1930s.
Oh, yes.
Just give us an idea what you did.
I went to a small branch, a sub-branch of this bank, which was a national provincial in those days, and that was a Thornaby on Tees, and there were only three people working there, the manager, the accountant, and the junior, and I started there as a junior. And had to type any letters that needed typing for the manager. I had to do all the accounts, the bookkeeping. And it's rather strange that at that time, in the beginning of 1933, there were actually gold sovereigns in the till. They didn't use them, but they were there in the till. But I was only there 3 months, and then I went to the main branch at Stockton, where the staff of 17 to 20, and there I did mostly machining and all sorts of duties where a junior was required. We used to have to go and take bills of exchange to merchants around the town, get money for them, and go out to agencies, and we're accompanied by a cashier, of course. And I used to go down once a week with a senior person and the messenger who owned a Riley 9 with the wages for quite a big company, Dorman Long & Company, which is now pretty well finished, I think. It's a steel company.
Did you enjoy the work?
Yes, I enjoyed the work. It was a novelty for me, and I got on quite well there.
Did you hanker for chemistry? Well, for a career as a chemist, or a...
Well, at that time, I was engaged with the banking world, and I really didn't go back to thinking too much about chemistry, except that I carried on with my chemistry experiments when I had time at home.
So you had your own laboratory then?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Well, what sort of thing would you have, and what experience? How advanced was your laboratory?
Well, it was mainly making other chemicals and things like that. I know I made a lot of explosives, which were successful. And another friend of mine, the same age, we did several things, blew up dustbins and things like that. Typical boys' tricks.
Did you have any other hobbies, or was that your main hobby?
Well, that was my main hobby, apart from cycling. I did a lot of cycling.
Do you remember one of the cycling clubs, or was it just private?
No, just with particular friends of mine, and one in particular, and we cycled from there across the Pennines and back in one day, quite a feat, of well over 100 miles, and quite half of it was uphill, of course, the first part. But I did a lot of cycling, and I enjoyed it.
Now, were you aware of what was going on? I mean, you're a very young chap then, but were you aware of what was going on in Germany? Were you conscious of any threat from Hitler, from National Socialism?
Oh, yes, I knew all about that, because 3 years later I was transferred to a branch, the main branch in Bradford in Yorkshire. That's part of the bank's policy to train you in one or two industries so that you are able to lend money to that particular industry when you are qualified. And my parents, from the time I left school, made sure that I was educated in other ways. I went every year abroad originally with my mother, Switzerland and Austria and places like that, and then on my own to Germany, Austria again, France, Belgium, even to Greece and Italy.
That's very unusual for those days.
It is, but my parents were not poor people. And at the age of, when I was old enough to drive a car, at about 17 I think it was, my father said to me that, in advance, when you are a day old enough to drive a car, you must take a license. We have two cars, your mother has one, I have one, and it's necessary for you to drive.
Now, what did you glean from your trips around Europe? We were talking about the rise of...
Yes, in Europe, I remember always staying in very nice places. The Grand Hotel in Nuremberg, in particular, where there was quite a lot of Nazi activity. That was about 1936. And I was aware of everything that went on, and I was warned as a holiday maker that what you mustn't do and what you must avoid in Germany. Mustn't start making jokes about Hitler and things like that. I saw all the officers there at this big hotel, and I formed my own conclusions. Also, when I worked in the bank, towards the approach of the war, I was on a particular job which involved reporting to the Bank of England every fortnight the movements of foreign currency. And I remember one of the things in particular, that approximately 2 weeks before the outbreak of war, one of the accounts that I reported, the Commerce und Privatbank, instructed us to transfer the funds at Bradford, which was the main office of the wool industry, to South America. And we did that.
So that gave you an inkling?
Well, it wasn't only that, but for the year before the war onwards, from 1938 onwards, at the head office we did a duplicate of all the transactions of the day, and they were dispatched to a place of securities in Wales. So we knew what was going on.
And what did you think of it all, yourself, you know, as a young chap?
Well, I thought it was something that was regrettable, but was obvious. It's bound to happen, more or less. There was no getting out of it.
So you'd be at Bradford from about...
3 years.
From 35 to...
36 to 39. Yeah.
Living in digs. Living in digs, then.
Oh yes, living in digs, yes, that was right.
How did you like it?
Well, I was with another person in the bank, and we got on well together, and that was no problem. I went home at weekends or every other week.
Now, were you still there when the war broke out in Bradford, or had you moved back to...
No, I was in Bradford when the war broke out, and I was there until I was called up.
Now, what do you remember of the outbreak of war, the actual day, the day that war broke out? What do you remember, what were you doing? Did you hear the broadcast?
Well, on the outbreak of war, it made very little difference, if any, in that area. We were remote from London, and apart from the blackout and things like that, it didn't affect us at all.
Did you hear the broadcast?
I don't remember hearing. I can't recall hearing things about it.
Did you think you'd be called up?
Oh, I was pretty sure that I would be called up.
Because you hadn't joined the territorials?
No, I'd joined nothing since I left school, and I was fairly certain that I would eventually have to join the forces in some way.
So there was a pretty well minimum... Weren't several of the bank clerks called up, that sort of thing? Didn't the war impact in that way during 39, before you were called up?
No, it didn't make any difference, really. We knew that the younger staff would go and the older ones would remain, and that was all the
way. It was all coped with. You weren't stretched, you didn't have to start employing women.
No. There were plenty of everything.
What sort of air raid precautions were introduced in Bradford?
None really directly affecting me. There was only blackout, and I never heard any sirens or anything like that.
No shelters?
No shelters, no.
Now, so the next thing then would be your call-up, I presume?
Yes, I got notice of this.
What was the actual call-up procedure? Because, how did they actually go about calling you up? Were you called in first for a medical inspection before you were called up, or what happened?
As far as I remember, I was merely notified about 2 weeks in advance to report to the place I had to do my training. And there I had all the procedure of examination.
So what was the date of your call-up?
It was early in July 1940, and I was group 26, I think.
And how did your parents react to you being called, and how did you feel about it?
Well, my parents were aware that I would be called up, and they just accepted it as a matter of course.
So they weren't particularly worried or upset?
No.